Hey, this episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast is brought to you by Rev.com. We do all of our transcriptions here on the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast using Rev.com, and I'm going to give you a special offer in just a bit.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is John Jantz, and my guest today is Jenny Blake. She is a former career development program manager at Google, and she is also the author of What to Do When You Need to Move Out of Your Parents' Basement. No, that's not it. We'll get back to that one. And the book we're going to talk about today, Pivot, The Only Move That Matters Is Your Next One. So, Jenny, thanks for joining me.
John, thank you for having me. I wish I wrote What to Do When You Move Out of Your Parents' Basement. That sounds like a great title.
I was talking one time about something to do with some sort of newish technology, and I'm guessing 25-ish year old said, "You're old. What do you know about that?" And so I had to write back to him and say, "Come up out of your parents' basement before they take away your Atari," or something like that. I can't remember, some snippy remark.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that and the alternate title for Pivot is How to Not End Up in a Van Down by the River.
So before we get into your latest book, what does a career development program manager do at Google?
I was there for 5.5 years, and halfway into my time there, so during that 5 years, the company grew from 6,000 to 36,000 employees, and one major issue became retention. How they hired all these smart recent grads from Ivy League schools, how do you then keep them once you get them there? And that was becoming an issue where these people were hitting plateaus 1 or 2 years into their time at the company. And so under the people operations department, they created a career development team. And I had been doing side projects related to this. So my job was, my biggest project was launching a global drop-in coaching program. But in general, our charge was creating programs that would help people learn and grow within the company and map their next move within the company so they didn't feel that their only option was to leave.
Yeah, it's funny. I imagine in an organization of that size, which, by the way, I've never even come close to working in, there probably is a whole lot of career moving that has to do, I mean, that happens internally. In fact, probably the day you show up, right, you start thinking about your next move internally.
Yeah, and internal mobility is not always an easy nut to crack because, you know, at one point there was a sentiment that it's easier to get hired here in the first place than it is to move to another team, because there are a lot of variables that have to happen internally, even just the visibility of what roles are open and how do I grow into them and how do I have those conversations with my manager, because it could be kind of scary to bring this stuff up.
Yeah, not to mention the politics too, which we won't go down a rabbit hole here, but I'm sure there's plenty of that too. People don't, unfortunately, don't want to see people grow beyond where they are today in some cases. But again, like I said, we won't go down that rabbit hole. The term pivot is used quite often today in startups. In fact, it's sort of a joke, you know, that you're expected to come out with your product and then you realize nobody wants it. And so you now are this kind of company. And so you pivot. How are you applying that now to careers?
Well, at first I started to ask, how can people be as agile as startups? And then quickly as I got to writing, and also I wanted a term that was judgment neutral and gender neutral when it came to career change, because previously we've just called them a midlife crisis or a quarter life crisis. And there was no word for this thing that's now happening every few years where we're all asking what's next much more often than in the past. And I recognized that what's different from the business context of the word pivot is that when startups talk about pivoting, it's because plan A failed. The original direction didn't work. And now, as you said, they have to pivot the business. But in our career, pivot is the new normal. It's not just plan B that we screwed something up. We hit pivot points all the time. Sometimes we choose to pivot. Sometimes we get pivoted. And truly, now more than ever, change is the only constant. So I wrote this book to create a method to more efficiently answer the question, what's next, given that we're going to be doing it much more often.
Yeah, and I actually see that, and again, you're not saying it's a generational thing necessarily, but I see that in, you know, my kids that are in their 20s, the sort of balance and scales of what's important seems to have changed in a way. I mean, it was at one time very important that you had this stable job, that it had a title, that obviously it had the money and the perks and things. And I see a lot of folks in, let's say, under 30s, that the idea of, I want to be really happy, I want freedom, I want to be able to do the things I want to do, sort of coming up in, you know, higher in the decision-making factor, which maybe has some of them saying, I'm going to change completely what I'm doing because I'm not happy.
Yes. And on the flip side, you have, there are 10,000 people turning 65 every day for the next 15 years. And many of them don't have any plans to stop working altogether or just go golf for the next 30 years. So you have millennials who saw many of their parents get laid off or reorged or be very unhappy when the recession hit in 2008. And so they kind of stepped back and said, what am I doing climbing this ladder that I don't know if I want to be on? And then again, all the way to boomers who are saying, I love what I do. I mean, I'm sure for you, John, like you've pivoted your business many times and probably, I don't know how you think about retirement, but I just think for so many of us, we're like, no, I love what I do. You know, I don't have any plan to cut it off cold turkey just because I turn a certain age.
Yeah. I mean, and my listeners know I'm 56. So, you know, I'm getting up there and where some people start thinking about that. And I've certainly changed what I do. I take a lot more time to go play and things of that nature. But yeah, the idea that I'm going to just stop, maybe never. I mean, I'll probably be writing books in my 70s and 80s.
That's how I feel too. And I think, we can say it'd be nice if finances were an option at that point. You know, we're not having to work incredibly hard just to survive, but that this creative output, my friend Neil Pasricha, maybe you know him, he wrote in The Happiness Equation about the Japanese term ikigai, the reason you wake up every day, and that working on creative pursuits. And so when I talk about pivoting, it is age and stage agnostic. It's that we're all constantly wondering, you know, what's next? And that's not a problem. That's not a personal shortcoming, the way that I think we've sometimes viewed it in the past.
You answered a question I was going to ask, who's this book for? So you're really saying it's for anybody who's, you know, still thinking about what they're doing that is making a living. So is there typically, or does it, you know, a lot of times people don't even realize they're unhappy. And they're just going along, and so they're not looking for like the next thing. Do people typically have a pivot moment or event that kind of says, I have to change?
Definitely. I mean, it can happen so many ways. I call them pivot points when you finally you realize, oh, I'm at a pivot point. For some who maybe have been ignoring the signals, your body starts to push back and maybe they get sick more often. Or my friend was getting panic attacks every time she got off the subway on her way to work. And that was a clear sign she was at a pivot point. Like you said, for others, it's more subtle. It's a more subtle kind of boredom or dissatisfaction. Some people are very proactive and they're just looking for what's next. And then sometimes we get pivoted. There are layoffs or a reorg, or we lose our biggest client. And so all of these are a moment where we can say, well, what's working and how do I double down on that and what's next? And I think when we get better at pivot as a mindset and the method itself, the pivot points are less sharp. They're less shocking that we don't see them coming and we feel blindsided. And that's when it is a crisis.
Well, and I think probably one of the biggest challenges for people, even if they know they need to make that pivot, it's like, it feels like you're standing on the edge of a cliff. I mean, maybe I have to quit a job. You know, maybe I don't know what I'm going to do next. All those things kind of hold people on for, you know, I talk to lots of people that are kind of sort of thinking about wondering if they could start a business, but they just can't jump because, well, maybe sometimes they're afraid, but other times there are practical realities about, you know, the commitments they have.
Yes, I have a whole chapter in the book on pivot finances because money is a very real constraint on pivoting and I would never pretend otherwise. And we also, my editor and I were very, very purposeful in not using language like leap or jump, that actually by running small career experiments, I call them pilots in the book, and by doubling down on what's working, people can methodically work toward their next move. And you know, eventually I call it a launch. Eventually there may be a launch moment of quitting your job and starting the business, but that by running small experiments, you do reduce risk along the way before you make that final launch decision.
You know, I have concluded over the years in interviewing hundreds and hundreds of people that the secret, one of the greatest secrets to success is self-awareness. And I think that so this whole idea of doing what makes you happy, I contend that most people don't know that and don't know what that looks like. And so consequently, don't know how to find it. Do you have the magic potion?
I think that people are clearer than they give themselves credit for. A lot of times when I ask someone, what do you want or what makes you most excited? They first might say, I don't know. And then if I say, well, just guess, what does your gut say? They always say things. They have so many things to say. And so I think sometimes it's actually just a fear of saying it out loud that holds us back from saying it. And so just giving space to admit and explore what success might be and what might bring you joy, even if you don't know how to get there yet, that's really important, is separating out the vision piece from the how, the whole how, as I call it in the book. And John, I'm actually curious because we talked offline and a few questions ago, you brought up kind of getting pivoted. And you and I were talking about when September 11th happened. I'm really curious how you responded in that moment with your business, because that there's a great example of you did not choose that event. None of us would in any scenario ever. And yet it affected so many people and it sparked so many pivots. So I'm actually curious to hear about yours in your business.
Well, so at that point I was kind of still on the path of what I would call traditional marketing consulting and agency. And we had a handful of employees and a handful of accounts that we did pretty much whatever they said they'd pay us to do. And as you mentioned, 9/11 came along, and you know, I think this happened in a lot of places, and it's not a direct correlation. I think it was partly, like a lot of things, change maybe needed to happen, and that was like a catalyst. But we lost our two biggest clients, partly because of you know, what was going on in their business, that was related to some of the downturn in the economy that happened, but it, again, is probably too complex to try to even figure out. But the bottom line was, we were sitting now staring at, 60% revenue loss or something, overnight. And I had already been working on this idea of duct tape marketing, on this idea of working exclusively with small businesses where I could create a system and say, here's what I'm going to do, here's what you're going to do, you know, here are the results we hope to get, here's what it costs. And so to your point about pivot, in a lot of ways, I was dragging my feet on that. But when we lost our clients, I said, you know, that's what I'm meant to do. And so I'm going to go do it. It did actually involve, in many ways, tearing my business back down to me and starting from scratch for the most part. But, you know, I can sell anything. So I knew that wasn't really going to be an issue. But it certainly was a pretty dramatic pivot. But it was kind of one, you know what I mean? It was one that I actually knew I needed to do anyway. And I really just needed to push.
It's so interesting how, yes, these moments, like losing two of your biggest clients, can turn out to be a blessing in disguise, even if at the time it's the most stressful thing you could possibly experience.
This episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast is brought to you by Rev.com. There are so many ridiculously valuable reasons to order transcriptions. You can write entire blog posts. Heck, you could write an entire book by just speaking it and having Rev put together a transcript that you can then just bring on home. I mean, if you want to record a meeting so that you have notes, again, over and over, there are so many good reasons. If you just want to take notes when you're listening to something and you just want to record those notes and get it, it's amazing what the reasons you can find for doing this. And Rev gets those transcripts. As I said, they do our podcast. They get those transcripts back to you lightning fast. And I'm going to give you a free trial offer. If you go to rev.com/blog/DTM, and that'll be in the show notes too, but you're going to get a $100 coupon to try them out, and I suggest you do it.
So you do have in the book and I actually think this, so many career advice books are kind of tell you what you should be doing, but don't tell you how to do it. And I think you have a really great methodology for, you know, how to identify, how to get there, how to figure out what you do, you know, that might signal, you know, what's next, like, as you mentioned, the, you know, how to finance it. So talk a little bit about this kind of search for, like, let's say I'm just unhappy. I know this isn't what I was meant to do. You know, how do I start kind of breaking down the hypothesis, so to speak, for what I'm meant to do next?
The biggest mistake that I made when pivoting that kept me stuck up for a lot longer than necessary without, by the way, a paycheck to fund this stuckness. My bank account was going very quickly to zero, was I spent way too much time looking at what wasn't working, what I didn't want, and what I didn't yet have. So my aha moment came to me. I sort of thought about this analogy of a basketball player, that when they stop dribbling, one foot is firmly grounded in the floor and it's very stable. And that's what I call the plant foot or the plant stage. And then their pivot foot can scan for opportunity. So one of the most effective ways to get unstuck is first to look at what's already working. What are my strengths? What are my interests? And again, that question of what does success look like? Now you have bracketed the pivot with where you are now and where you want to end up. And then you can start scanning for options, people, skills, and opportunities that are compelling. And it's when people are scanning with most people, when they think I've hit a pivot point, they go straight to scanning. What's out there? And they fall into compare and despair and analysis paralysis, and they feel they're wasting time. And they are, because it's not rooted in anything. It's not grounded in those plant components. And so everything starts from that plant stage, and then you're scanning. And then a real key is the piloting small experiments, because we don't know. We don't know. I think of it like, I love metaphors. They just help me. So think about pilots, like you have all these racehorses at the starting gate, and you don't know which of your small career experiments are going to take off and emerge in the lead. And so career pilots, because that's kind of a newer concept to think about experiments in a career sense, that could be in your business. It could be piloting a new pricing structure. It could be piloting a new type of client. It could be taking a class. It could be launching a beta version of a program or a workshop before you roll it out to your whole audience. A pilot could be calling your previous clients, which I know, John, is something that you advocate, and asking, what can I create for you? What do you want? And then try something in a scrappy way before you pour 6 months of work and $5,000 into it.
Yeah, and I think what's really cool is, you know, this gig economy or world that we live in. I mean, there's a whole lot of things you can freelance and do, you know, on the side even, to maybe finance some of what you're doing, but probably more than anything else, give you a sense of what that would be like. Because I know a lot of people, you know, get this idea of here's what I want to do, and they jump into it, and then they go, oh, well, that wasn't what I wanted to do. I figured it out now. And so there's so many ways you can test this, aren't there?
Yeah, and I feel like even within the broader career umbrella. So let's say you and I are running businesses. Well, we could still be piloting different income streams within that. Now you're the king of this. So I'm curious, what is one pilot or two that you could share that you've got going in addition to the core elements of your business?
Well, my point of view is that you're constantly piloting. So I'm everything we do. I learned long ago that if I locked myself in a room and worked on something for 6 months and then rolled it out and said, ta-da, you know, there was about a 90% chance that people are going to go, that's not what we want. So what our method for developing any new program or tool or course is to go to people that we know already understand the value we bring and say, we're kind of sort of thinking about doing this. What would that look like for you? And then come back and say, here's what it looks like based on your feedback. How much would you pay for that? Try this out. So we're kind of, anytime we develop anything, it is really with our clients or with the market. And again, there are certainly people that have had tremendous successes creating stuff that people didn't even know they needed. But I find the really safe route is to go to a market and let them kind of develop and create with you.
Yes, I love that too. And that then it becomes such a co-creation. And I know you've talked so much about that in your books too. It's having one ear to the ground. That's one of the things about the scanning stage. It's not just about trying to guess and pull things out of the ether. It's about listening and doing, in the design thinking community, they call it empathy interviews, which is just getting to know, as you just described, what people are actually would love help with.
And I really think it's again, it's like, you know, having these board meetings and planning strategy. I mean, I think that you have to actually go out there in the real world and experience strategy or experience what you're planning before, and then have it know that it's going to evolve, rather than to simply, you know, throw a dart at a board and say, here's what I'm doing.
Yes. And I think any good experiment will test what I call the three E's. One, do I enjoy this potential new direction? Two, can I become an expert at it? And three, is there room in the market to expand? And so sometimes a pilot will hit on two, but not the third. You know, if I love underwater basket weaving and I'm a pro, but nobody wants to buy those classes from me, it's no good. So I think part of it is just continuing to see what's really going to catch on all those fronts.
Is there a risk of, you know, with this, you know, I see a lot of folks at organizations, they've been there 2 years, and it's like, what's wrong with you? You know, you're going to get stuck. I mean, is there a risk of too much of that thinking to the point where people are just constantly looking elsewhere rather than maybe upping their game where they are?
Absolutely. That was something that I thought long and hard about with this book, because I don't advocate just changing willy-nilly or pivoting or job hopping the second things get hard. I have a section where I talk about unrealized gains, and on the other end of the spectrum, diminishing returns. So unrealized gains are, you don't stick with anything long enough to get any value. You're leaving gains, whether it's financial, reputation-based, or results-based gains. If I had left Google when I first entertained the thought, 2.5 years in, it would have been a huge mistake, because I wouldn't have created this global coaching program that's now mentioned on the cover of my book. You know, I got a lot of experience capital from staying. And so
plus a bunch of stock options.
Yeah, a few. Not enough so that I didn't have to worry about my next pivot in 2 years. But I know, I wish I had started pre-IPO. Maybe I wouldn't even be on this podcast. I would just be on a beach in Tahiti.
No, we just would be talking about something different. But you'd want to be
true,
for sure.
True. I think that a part of it is also recognizing that we can pivot within our current role. So whether that's within your own business or you're working for someone else, pivoting is not always these drastic shifts. It's just a method to work your way into what's next.
So what are some kind of quick, either you can make them either do's or don'ts, whichever way you want to go, some kind of quick things that people that either kind of sabotage their, you know, their ability to pivot or kind of keep the ground fertile at all times?
Yeah, one of the biggest pitfalls, again, is not looking at what's already working. Another pitfall is trying to stretch too far. So there's the comfort zone, stretch zone, but then sometimes people will have a move that sends them into their panic zone, where they're just paralyzed and not taking any action at all. That's a sign that your experiment is too big, or your turn is too sharp on the, if we look at the pivot on an angle from where you are now, it's too sharp. So I'd say those are the biggest mistakes. And then another mistake is taking a pivot personally. We talked about this a little bit at the start, but seeing a career plateau as a problem or a personal shortcoming, when actually it's fine. For maybe some of your listeners know about the S curve, which is often we refer to in terms of innovation cycles. And there's this natural tapering that happens, and then you start over. And I'm sure, you know, even everyone who's self-employed, you're in a growth spurt, and then it tapers because of your success, not because of anything you did wrong. It just, you hit these natural plateaus. So
yeah. So in some ways, it's probably important to continue to look for things that excite you, if nothing else, because it just, if you're going to put in the work, why not enjoy it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So where can people find out more about Pivot and the Pivot Method?
Yes, the website is pivotmethod.com. And then they can also listen to the Pivot podcast, which anywhere you subscribe to casts. John Jance has been a guest on my show, so that will be coming out soon. And I'm on Twitter at Jenny_Blake.
And of course, the book can be gotten wherever people get their books.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, Jenny, thanks so much for stopping by today, and hopefully we'll see you soon out there on the road.
John, thank you so much for having me, and big thanks to everybody for listening.